number 91, National
Advancement of Colored People, Petitioner versus State of Alabama. Mr. Patterson, or Mr. Reinhardt.
Mr. Chief Justice, just before closing, you asked me a question concerning the Alabama statutes dealing with this, these domestication statutes and the enforcement thereof.
Yes.
There are two criminal statutes. They are set out in the petitioner's brief at page 36 in a footnote. One of those denies a foreign corporation, which makes a contract in Alabama, the power to assert their rights under that contract.
Yes.
They'd also set certain penalties, which are misdemeanors, and those are enforced by the solicitors of our respective circuits and counties, and on appeals by the Attorney General's office would handle those. Those are the only statutes in Alabama which deal with what we would call the enforcement. That is a method of penalizing a corporation or its agents for coming in and doing business without a license. We do not place our action or base our action in any way on those. In fact, part of the basis of our action is that those do not provide an adequate remedy at law.
Well, what I was thinking about, Mr. Reinhardt, was whether, as a penalty for having been delinquent in not filing, there was any authority in anyone to say to that corporation that you cannot now qualify. I can see that there would be any number of penalties that might attach to it, but is there such a penalty as a denial of the right to register because of a delinquency in registering beforehand?
Not a penalty, but we believe a power in the Court of Equity, in its equity jurisdiction, to police, perhaps police is not the correct word, to supervise corporations once it has jurisdiction of the subject matter, in this case, to maintain the status quo. We petitioned not only for a temporary injunction, but a permanent injunction, and ultimately an order of ouster, basing it on the power of the state to exclude a corporation completely. If we had not in the first place let it in, we naturally concede if we let a corporation in, we allow it to qualify, we can't then turn around and say, we're sorry, we just don't like you anymore. Or we can't ask them to waive their constitutional rights in advance and coming in as a condition preceding to entry. But where they are interlopers, as we consider this corporation to be, doing business in Alabama without even the slightest action toward complying with our laws, that they're interlopers and that they have absolutely no right to be here, and that the equity power is the only effective way to protect and vindicate the constitutional provision which is involved here, the Constitution, that is, of Alabama, Section 232, and that the equity courts have that power. And if they have the power to oust, they have the lesser included power to restrain their qualifying. That's one of the reasons we think that the records, that to get to the merits of this case, now I mean the merits before the circuit court, is so important in this case to determine whether or not they should be ousted in a proceeding in equity in the nature of quo warranto, such as Kansas did in State X. Rel. Griffith against Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. That is the gravamen of the state's petition, a sworn bill, I might add, it's a sworn bill in equity, which was filed on June 1, 1956.
Does your statute regarding the domestication of foreign corporations have a provision that until such a certificate or whatever you call it is had, foreign corporation can't sue in your court?
If they are doing business in Alabama without qualifying, they cannot sue in our courts. That is correct. I stand corrected on that. They may not enforce rights in our court growing out of that business in Alabama. Yes, a corporation may come in and sue, for instance, an insurance company, in certain conditions, and that is not considered doing
business.
They are
a legal person capable of being brought, coming into court, and being brought, as this case shows, into court.
That is correct.
They've got a legal existence, as it were, subject to handicaps.
Of an extremely limited nature.
Yes, I know, but they're subject to handicaps.
That is correct, sir.
I'm not clear as to what you consider the relevancy of these records to be.
We allege they are doing intrastate business in Alabama. One of the most important phases of that business, and there are others alleged, and which are not admitted, is that they are soliciting members. We allege and believe a large number of members. That is a financial transaction conducted in Alabama by agents of this organization to support branches which we allege they control in Alabama, and that is doing business in Alabama, that we are in the position of proving that, and it's going to, the best way of proving how a corporation operates that I know of is to get their records and look at them and see what they really do, what their own records show.
I thought Mr. Carter said yesterday that they were prepared to admit that they were
done. No, they were prepared to admit, and if I may, I shall read from the record. I am now reading from record pages 6 and 7. The last full paragraph on page 6, beginning on July 23. Petitioner filed its answer admitting, 1, that it was a New York corporation, 2, that it maintains its Southeast regional office in Birmingham, 3, that it hired and employed agents to operate this office, but denied that it had organized local chapters in the state, and that the agents of the corporation solicited for said local chapters and the parent corporation. Denied that it had employed or paid money to Authorine Lucy and Polly Myers Hudson to encourage or aid them enrolling in the University of Alabama. Admitted 6, furnishing legal counsel to Authorine Lucy in prosecuting her suit against the University of Alabama. Admitted 7, that it had given moral and financial support to Negro residents of Montgomery in connection with their refusal to use the public transportation system of Montgomery, and had furnished legal counsel to assist Reverend M.L. King and other Negroes indicted in connection with that matter, but denied all other allegations and inferences contained in that allegation and bill of complaint, and denied 8, that its officers, agents, or employees have engaged in organizing chapters for the corporation in Alabama and Montgomery County, collecting dues, soliciting memberships, loaning or giving personal property to aid present aims of the corporation. Admitted that it had never filed with the Secretary of State articles of incorporation or designated place of business or authorized agents within the state, but denied 10, that it was required by sections 192, 193, and 194 of Title 10, Code of Alabama, 1940, to do so. Petitioner denied that it has violated Article 12, Section 232, Constitution of Alabama, 19(1), and Section 192, 193, and 194, Title 10, Code of Alabama, 1940. Further, petitioner denied 11, that his acts are causing irreparable injury to the property and civil rights of the citizens, residents and citizens of the state of Alabama. Now, we do not concede that that is an admission of doing business in Alabama. In fact, it is one of those things that say we're admitting we're doing A, B, and C, but we deny these other things, and when you get all finished, your laws don't apply. Now, Section 232 is all-inclusive. It says all corporations doing business in Alabama, and I can only construe that to mean that they're saying that while we admit doing certain things, we're not doing business in Alabama, in the meaning of your laws.
Well, Mr. Reinhart, doesn't the next paragraph, though, bear on that
Uh, You mean the assertion that...
It's a short paragraph. Suppose you read that.
Yes, Your Honor. In addition to the various defenses to the bill of complaint petitioner, while asserting that Title 10, Sections 192, 193, and 194 of the Code of Alabama 1940 was not applicable, had procured the necessary forms from the Office of the Secretary of State, Montgomery, Alabama, and had filled in the forms as required by law and offered to file same. Said forms were attached to his answer, and petitioner stated that it would file these forms if the court would dissolve its orders barring petition from registering and would permit petitioner to file the forms attached to his answer. We submit it does not, and for some very definite reasons. On reviewing the chronology of this case, you will see that petitioner didn't file any pleadings until 31 days after the temporary injunction. That on the 5th of July, which was 3 days after, and I might add that then the trial judge set down the hearing on the motion to dissolve the temporary injunction for the 16th of July. The state then moved to produce, moved for an order for them to produce, which motion was heard on the 9th of July, which counsel for the petitioner was present. The case was fully argued and presented on that question purely of the production. And the order was granted on the 11th. Then their time was extended, and the order said produce on the 16th, which was the day before the hearing on the motion to dissolve the temporary injunction. Now, Alabama procedure is that while oral testimony may not be introduced on such a hearing as a matter of right, you can put it in if it isn't objected to. But in addition, the hearing can be on affidavits of both sides. We thought it extremely important to have those records to sustain and buttress the allegations of the bill, to prepare affidavits, to obtain affidavits from people. Well, then the trial judge extended their time to produce. He correspondingly extended our time for the hearing because we needed those documents in connection with the hearing. Now then, at the last hour, or if not the 12th hour, at least the 11th hour, they come in with an answer. Now, we're not interested in a corporation filing these papers if they don't have to file them. If they are exempt, they don't need to tender it. No, Alabama isn't interested in a corporation not doing business in Alabama filing these documents. We're not trying to assert a right we don't have, but we think we're entitled to a hearing on the merits as to whether or not they're doing business in Alabama, because our ultimate aim in this, admittedly, I couldn't deny it on what we've alleged here, is that we think their long past record of ignoring our laws warranted something more than a slap on the wrist, saying, well, now you can pay it and go and sin no more. But we felt that, like Kansas, we had a right to oust them completely.
May I ask you this? You correct me if my misunderstanding, my understanding is inaccurate. You brought ouster proceedings against the NAACP. They said they didn't come within your law, either because they're a membership corporation of New York, or because what they did in Alabama doesn't amount to what, legally speaking, is doing business in Alabama. But they said, as people often say, I think too seldom say, on the advice of counsel, well, whether we are right or wrong, it's easier for us to comply. So they say, we're ready to file this certificate if this is what you want from us. But they did contest the coercive power of Alabama to make them file. That's correct, isn't it? Didn't they deny that they come within your law requiring to do anything, including what they did do in Alabama?
I agree. What they offered to do in Alabama.
What you say they have been doing over these years during which they didn't file, or they should have filed, a certificate to domesticate themselves. Isn't that true? You say they've been doing business for a good many years in Alabama, certainly way back since 1918, probably earlier, in connection with their purposes.
That is correct.
So that you've been doing business without the requisite permission of Alabama. They said, we don't come within your law. We didn't have to satisfy the requirement of getting a certificate. But in the interest of whatever it is, convenience, we're ready to file a certificate. And you said, no, we don't have to accept that. Is that right?
That is correct.
Now, and on the basis of the facts thus quickly summarized, the state got a restraining order against him, calling for the cessation of all business. Although they raised what I suppose is not a frivolous or a ridiculous objection to the claim asserted by the state. Is that right?
I know you don't
think there's much to the point, but I'm sometimes surprised how often the majority of my brethren think there's something to a point in which I think there's nothing to. Or vice versa.
I accept everything except the very last statement with a reservation as being absolutely a correct statement.
All right.
What we say is this. First statement I want to make is that the offer which they made was after the, ex parte restraining order. And the offer wasn't made until after we were going to get down to the nub of the case, the facts of the case. And that is something I think that should be borne in mind in dispelling this, which I think petitioners tried to create, this aura of unfairness in Alabama.
Well, what I've stated was merely preliminary to the...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I didn't think on that statement that Alabama did something that was wrong. This is merely I wanted to see that the preliminary facts that seem to me relevant to the question I'm going to put to you were correct.
They are, sir.
Very well. Then you get a restraining order against them not to do business. They must shut up shop. Is that right?
Yes. They have not at that point, however, made any offer of compliance whatsoever.
No, but you did give. You told them they must shut up shop.
That is correct.
Before the validity of that order, not only the validity of the order, but the scope of the decree could be contested, the state begins another proceeding and says, produce certain documents. That's correct, isn't it?
That is correct.
They say you're asking us to produce documents which we are entitled by whatever rights we, by the rights we have under the United States Constitution to withhold. That certainly is not a frivolous question.
No, that is not a frivolous question.
That being so, what I want to put to you is that pending the determination of what is not a frivolous question, what is a substantial, at least a question that respectable lawyers can raise and do raise and have raised. Alabama takes the position that although this organization has been in Alabama all these years without any attention or objection from the authorities of Alabama, I'm not talking about estoppel, I'm addressing myself to the nature of the remedy. Although that has been so, and although they raise a question ancillary to the proceedings of ousting, Alabama says, you go out of business until this long trail of litigation because you have, standing on constitutional rights, said you don't have to obey this. Alabama then throws them in contempt, but all this time they are executed. They get a death sentence pro tem, although in the end it may turn out that they were constitutionally right. Isn't that a fair statement of this litigation?
I'm going to make one correction, and I think
please do.
The most important correction. Alabama did not throw them into contempt. They need never have been in contempt. They could have tested the order to produce without ever the slightest risk of contempt.
Well, they tested it in the way in which they thought they can test it according to your cases.
Our cases don't hold that as the proper
way. Well, that is a question before us, whether they raised it by whether the certiorari by which they sought to raise it raised all these issues.
And
even your Supreme Court said we don't have to consider these, but we do consider them.
It's
allowable for counsel to think they had a right to pursue it this way.
I would like to address myself to that specific question in considerable detail and explain the fairness of the Alabama procedure, and that is this. The Alabama procedure on a subpoena ducis tecum, if it, in case of a third party, or a motion, an order to produce documents, is an interlocutory order not appealable. The proper remedy is petition for writ of mandamus. And why is that? Because the person does not have to set himself up as the sole judge of relevancy, the sole judge of constitutionality, and bring himself to the position of flat out, as this petitioner did in open court, of saying, we don't need any more time. We choose to stand on these rights.
Now, so far as I'm concerned, and that's the only person for whom I can ever speak, so far as I'm concerned, if it can be established that the orderly, traditional, settled procedure of Alabama requires the raising of this question solely by mandamus, then I think the other side is out of court, so far as I'm concerned. Because Alabama has a right to say it should be raised by mandamus and not by certiorari. If you're right.
If I'm right. Well, we have cited in our brief at pages 9 and 17 thereof, ex parte Monroe County Bank, 254 Alabama 515. Now that, I will grant you, the Monroe County Bank was not a party to the action. They were, this was a subpoena ducis tecum. In that case, they didn't choose or felt that they did not have the duty to produce certain records in a divorce proceedings. Husband against wife, and of course these financial matters become very important. They proceeded by writ of mandamus to test the validity of that subpoena ducis tecum in the Alabama courts. And we went to the Supreme Court, and all the questions were passed on. Now, that isn't enough. That doesn't make a great long line of cases. In addition, ex parte Hart, cited in the Supreme Court's opinion, had a similar question of an order to produce. The court didn't discuss that thing at length. It was just the well-accepted method in Alabama.
If my reading, with all the consciousness that one should have about reading the decisions of a state, the law of which he isn't familiar except by a reading, if my reading of your cases were a consistent doctrine that mandamus is the exclusive remedy, I would have to go with you. But if my reading of your cases is that sometimes Alabama does, and sometimes Alabama doesn't allow all the substantive questions to be raised on certiorari, then I say to you that it can't invoke that doctrine when a federal right is asserted, when it doesn't invoke it in other instances.
All right. I don't know of a case where a petition for certiorari has ever been treated as a petition for writ of mandamus.
That is what I suggested. I don't think this court, I don't think I can say that that which the Supreme Court of Alabama treats as certiorari should be deemed to be a mandamus. That's not my function. But if I find that on certiorari it has intermittently considered all substantive questions, then it can draw the curtain when a federal question is
The cases which both parties have cited, ex parte Morris, at pages 8, 14, and 15 of the respondent's brief, is a case which comes to mind, as well as the instant case. Of course, we submit in the instant case, the Supreme Court of Alabama said we are going to exposit, essentially, we're going to demonstrate for future guidance our views, but they did not make them the basis of the decision. And I think that's a very important distinction to make, an extremely important one, in this case, and also in ex parte Morris. Ex parte Morris concerned this question. An officer of the Ku Klux Klan was directed to bring before the grand jury records of that corporation, of that organization.
Is this a Kansas case?
No, this is not, sir.
This is an Alabama case.
Yes. This was a grand jury proceeding, a preliminary, I suppose, to some criminal action.
Yes.
And he said he stood on his constitutional rights not to do it. And was held in contempt. He was brought in before the judge, and the judge says, you'll produce him. Now, Then filed a petition for certiorari, which is the established law of Alabama for reviewing contempt citations, whether civil or criminal. And the writ for certiorari was denied because on the face of the proceedings, the court had jurisdiction. Nice little memorandum decision. Then they said, however, we're going to exposit our views on these constitutional questions, not as a basis of decision, as I read the case, but merely because we'd like people to know that corporations, for example, don't have a privilege against self-incrimination, don't have a right of secrecy. Now, those are the chief cases which I have studied on this, other than and that I know of myself, that really face up to these problems, except Ex parte Dickens, also cited in petitioner's brief and our brief. If you wish, I'll refer to the page number, and I can explain that case, too. And show that the merits of the case were not considered. In that case, petition for certiorari, what was considered was contempt of an order to deliver certain bonds and other documents to a receiver in equity. The court reiterated the traditional view that certiorari, you look at the face of the proceedings. You see whether there was jurisdiction of the persons, the parties, I should say, jurisdiction of the subject matter, whether there was a contempt, whether all the procedural aspects of a contempt proceeding are followed, remembering that it is a completely ancillary proceeding. Now, and they held that, in fact, since the face of the proceeding showed that, in fact, that he had obeyed the order and that there hadn't been any new order, even though a new receiver had been appointed, there was no contempt. They went on to say that if there was a question of a payment of a debt, that that could be reviewed on petition for writ of habeas corpus. Now, they didn't say, they didn't do as the Morris case, and in this case, they didn't say, well, now, we've said all we're going to say all we have to say. They just went on and discussed this question of writ of habeas corpus, that had he been imprisoned in this case to pay a debt, which might well have been the case, why then he could have reviewed it for petition for writ of habeas corpus. Now, there may be other cases in Alabama. I regret I don't know of any others which bear on this issue.
Now, suppose one finds that while, as a matter of nicety, your court thinks mandamus is the way to do it, but suppose as a matter of practice one finds that in fact they do consider, in fact, as a matter of judicial habit or course of judicial practice, they do consider the merit, and that one further finds that they drew the distinction in this case, which they haven't drawn in others, and reaches the merit. Let's make that assumption.
I understand.
If you can. We lawyers can see both sides, at least we're supposed to. What do you say then? Assume that the case is here, in other words, and is not to be dismissed because of a want of a federal question, or the want of the disposition of on a local ground. What do you say to the procedure, to the decree, the restraining order, which puts an enterprise out of business, although it barely raises federal constitutional questions, and although no ground, at least that I have heard mentioned, maybe giving some, there's no serious ground for saying anything will happen. There'll be irreparable damage if you, for the time being, you don't put a body out of business, although ultimately it may be found that you had no business to restrain it at all.
I am to assume this fact, and this is the only one I understand, that the case history of Alabama shows that while they pretend to this nicety of pleading and practice, that in fact, when they get one of these important questions, why they simply just say, well, we're going to look at the thing anyway. That's what I am to assume.
And that that they drew the line here, that you're asking us to draw the line here, but we find the case that, as a matter of fact, your court did review it, did review the issue, the federal question that is here, that is thought to be brought here, and that, therefore, it is here. Just stop with that.
Then I think that there is that the state of Alabama has an extremely dubious case of no federal question. In other words, but if you can reach this position, which it would seem to me you were heading, that they decided to make some sort of an exception in this case, then I think that we're perilously close to a case which was decided here Monday, this Baxley case. I don't concede entrapment, however, or Springs in this case.
Mr. Reinhardt, how in Alabama do you raise the question of whether or not a preliminary injunction was legally or illegally entered?
On a motion to dissolve.
Well, that's what I thought. Now, until the motion to dissolve has been heard, you're not out of the trial court, and there's nothing yet to review.
That is our contention, and that is correct under my understanding of the law.
Now, you have two aspects here. One is the temporary injunction, but as a collateral appendage to the determination of the question of whether or not the injunction might be maintained, an order was entered by the trial court for the production of certain documents.
That is correct.
Under the law of Alabama, does the court have an inherent or a statutory power to impose penalty for disobedience of his order?
It has an inherent power.
All right. Now,
and also a statutory in the case of criminal contempt.
Now, what's the remedy that's final when the penalty is assessed, isn't it? That's immediately reviewable, whether by appeal, certiorari, mandamus, or whatnot, isn't it?
That is correct.
Now, how do you get a review on that issue? You say by mandamus, is that right?
Because we break it down into two steps. You have really two ancillary proceedings and ancillary questions. You have first the validity of the order to produce, which is tested by mandamus. And secondly, then if they choose to just say, as this petitioner did, I don't know why they didn't file a petition for writ of mandamus, but they didn't. To test only the order to produce. And if you then choose the route of saying,
to test only the conviction for contempt for disobedience to the order to produce, is what you mean, isn't it?
No. First, the mandamus goes only to test the validity of the order to produce and may be commenced at any time after the order is entered, it being an interlocutory, non-appealable order.
Well, now, in Missouri, you would have to do this not by a mandamus, but by a prohibition. Now, but in your state, you do it by a mandamus.
Frankly, if I may say so, the writ of mandamus and writ of prohibition if I were a purist, I would say often what appears to be mandamus is a writ of prohibition.
Now, let's go back to the injunction feature, the temporary injunction. How is that reviewed after the motion to dissolve has been overruled? How do you review that?
By appeal.
By a direct appeal.
That is correct. Okay.
Is certiorari a discretionary writ in Alabama?
Absolutely. And there's a very important point to be made in connection with that. Mr. Justice Brennan.
Sure, I understand this. Are you suggesting that on your analysis of the Alabama cases, there is none where, in fact, in review on certiorari of an order of civil contempt, your Supreme Court has ever reviewed the merits of an order, of the underlying order which was disobeyed and upon which the contempt finding was made?
That is correct. Now, there was a case cited yesterday which I was not personally aware of. I believe I have that citation, 68 Southern 2nd, 834, this Armstrong case, which is a, we maintain the court did not look at the merits. This isn't one of those cases where they applied for certiorari and it was treated as mandamus. The case isn't at all that case.
Well, I'm not addressing myself to that. I'm addressing myself to what happens when, in fact, an order of civil contempt is reviewed on writ of certiorari.
Oh, this was...
Does your Supreme Court entertain argument and dispose of any arguments addressed to the validity of the order alleged to have been disobeyed?
That Armstrong case is the only case that I know of that bears, that seems to even bear on it. And that, in fact, was an appeal from the denial of the court to hold the man in contempt, to take contempt proceeding against him, even though he had very possibly, on the record, violated the order. And then they threw in a sort of general prayer on top of the appeal. And the court reviewed the portion of the contempt proceedings. They also reviewed other matters on the merits of the whole case, as I see it, on the appeal feature. But specifically on the contempt feature, they said, well, we, as far as this contempt, pure contempt angle, we'll consider to that extent certiorari. And they did, in fact, they didn't look at the merits except to this extent, which is the established Alabama law, of to see whether or not there was a contempt.
Well, does that involve whether or not there was a contempt? That is, whether or not there was a disobedience to the order?
That is correct.
And to decide whether there's been a disobedience to the order, don't we have to decide whether features of the order alleged to have been disobeyed are valid or not?
I see what you're absolutely what you're getting at.
I
understand.
The scope of the actual review on certiorari in a civil contempt proceeding.
In that case, they did in fact hold that this was a proper order. As I say, it seemed to me they looked at it on the appeal feature. In other words, the appeal. And this question of appeal, whether the order was an order which was proper.
In relation to the injunction feature?
Not in our case. I'm not speaking of Mr. Justice Whitaker. I'm talking about this Armstrong case, which was one of these custody of children cases, among other things, and also a question of accrued alimony. There were a number of complicating features, and I see the not only the drift of the question, but you do get sort of to that point, and all I can say is that as far as the way the court talks, they say we're looking strictly at the face of these contempt proceedings for jurisdiction.
Well, what I'm getting at is anyone reading the Alabama cases and finding that, in fact, on a writ of certiorari, the review of civil contempt order, that the Supreme Court of Alabama actually inquires into the validity of the order alleged to have been disobeyed, would he not think that that was an appropriate, he might appropriately believe that the next time he came up by certiorari, not only would the contempt itself, whether there's been a disobedience, but as well, whether or not what was disobeyed was valid would be considered by your Supreme Court.
I think that if the case is in fact ran that way, I think that you would be correct. I don't know of any cases that do go that way. The Armstrong case is the closest thing to that.
Frankly, what I'm addressing myself to, I noticed that you have your Supreme Court had a per curiam, which is in 91 Southern 2nd at 221. At the time, there was an application for a stay to the Supreme Court. I think that was the application of July 31st, wasn't it?
I would like to explain exactly what happened in that case. They made an application for stay. There was no petition for certiorari. There wasn't any kind of pleading. They just went up there and said, we're in this terrible fix. There were no facts or anything. Just stay the proceedings. And the court said, it's a question of a contempt proceeding, certiorari, the contempt proceeding, the review of a contempt proceeding, we have to have a petition for certiorari. We don't have jurisdiction.
That's just the point. But the way the per curiam reads is, it is the established rule of this court that the proper method of reviewing a judgment for civil contempt of the kind here involved is by a petition for common law writ of certiorari. And this court has through the years felt impelled to grant the writ for the purposes of review where a reasonable ground for its issuance is properly presented in such petition. And it was after that decision and that per curiam that the first petition for certiorari, I see it all on the same page, on August 13, rather cryptically, was denied on the ground that the insufficient to warrant the issuance of the writ, the averments of the petition are insufficient. Doesn't say in what respect insufficient. And then was followed in August, the petition which led to the judgment and opinion before us. And I'm just wondering how anyone was involved in this very case, if reading your cases before this one, felt that there was going to be a review both of the underlying order as well as of the contempt itself. I could help but take this as an instruction of your Supreme Court. Go ahead, follow the rules of writ of certiorari, and we'll consider both the contempt and the order upon which it was based.
First of all, taking what was actually before the court, in the second petition, it had no facts alleged. There were merely what we can call assignments of error, which are set out in our brief. I stand corrected on that.
I can't find anywhere in the record any of these papers that underlay either of those applications. Are they in this record, do you know, Mr. Rankin? Are they not in the printed
record? No, they are not in this record. They are not.
They haven't been filed with this court either?
They have not.
None of these underlying papers that...
Not to my knowledge. The printed record in this case, which consists of petition for writ of certiorari and exhibits, is the record in the case. But...
If the original petition on which the contempt order was issued in the record...
It is included. The state's petition is included in the record.
Where is it?
Record pages 1, 2, and 3. I stand corrected. What I should say is that this is a synopsis and rather of our petition. It is not the petition itself. I stand corrected. The petition itself that we filed in the initial proceedings is not in this record.
Mr. Reinhart, do you suppose, I don't know if it's appropriate or not, you tell me if you don't think so, if you don't believe it is. Could we have provided us the record on all of these applications to your Supreme Court, the petitions that were filed, all the rest
of it? I do not have them with me here. I am certain that if asked for, they will all be supplied. All that was before the Supreme Court was sent up, that was asked for from the Supreme Court. Now, in addition, was this initial petition for certiorari. I'm not addressing myself now to our petition, but this initial petition for certiorari, which page appears at pages 16 and 17 of the record. I should again qualify that statement by saying that these are the grounds alleged in that and that all that was alleged in it was what I call an assignment of errors.
As I understand, the only one we have here is petition which was filed on the 20th of August.
That is correct.
And apparently there was a petition filed somewhere around August the 13th, which we do not have, and as to which your court's
Supreme Court said that the averments were insufficient. Then before that, on July 31, there must have been some kind of paper filed in connection with a motion for stay, and we don't have that paper either.
That is correct. We concurred in the record in this case.
I noticed that from the file in the clerk's office.
Mr. Reinhardt, your time is just about up. I wonder if you can address yourself to the merits.
I should be happy to, Your Honor.
Now,
there are really several questions of the merits involved here. There is first the question of the state's power to take any such initial action. And we base that on the plenary common law powers of the Attorney General of Alabama to vindicate and enforce the public policy of Alabama concerning the domestication of foreign corporations. I'm talking about that constitutional provision, Section 232, which is self-implementing. We think that an attorney general has the inherent right, and in fact, it is not set out in the briefs. I have it here. I'm now reading from the Alabama Code of 1940, which also includes the Alabama Constitution, Article 12, Section 232.
What is it? Would you mind reading
it? Right now. No foreign corporation shall do any business in this state without having at least one known place of business and an authorized agent or agents therein, and without filing with the Secretary of State a certified copy of its articles of incorporation or association, period. Such corporation may be sued in any county where it does business by service of process upon an agent anywhere in the state. The legislature shall, by general law, provide for the payment to the state of Alabama of a franchise tax by such corporation, but such franchise tax shall be based on the actual amount of capital employed in this state, period. Strictly benevolent, educational, or religious corporations shall not be required to pay such tax.
Your time has expired, but you may have 5 minutes more to summarize the merits. You stick to the merits.
I certainly shall.
Yes.
I was saying that we have the plenary common law powers, that the Attorney General of Alabama is a constitutional officer who has the same powers which the Attorney General of Great Britain had at common law. We depend upon those cases, a long line of cases, which say that a corporation doing intrastate business in a state, or rather the Supreme Court decisions, which say that a corporation may be prevented doing intrastate business within a state if it hasn't first gone there and conformed to the laws of that state.
Is there any law of Alabama which tells a delinquent corporation that it cannot register?
Absolutely not. No statutory law whatsoever.
In considering the merits, the means of the evidence, you would tell me what issue was left upon which an order could rest to produce paper.
Whether
after you had, on your petition, to ask these people, because they were delinquent, after they had offered to file with the Secretary of State a certificate, which if they had been permitted to file, he could not have refused. What issue was left on which orders could be issued in your pleadings after that?
I think that the authority to oust is in the courts of Alabama to punish, perhaps punish is too strong a word, but to, I believe it is the correct one, for having for a long period of time ignored our laws. And the question of whether in fact they were doing business and how long and the extent and nature of their were absolutely essential to the case. Now, we think that the power to oust for past misconduct included the power to maintain the status quo as between the parties. And that is what this order denying the right to register did. It's traditional power of a court of equity.
Have they ever done that?
No, we've never had a case like this before.
Never had a case where corporations were delinquent?
We've had cases where corporations... I won't say that. I don't know of anywhere corporations were delinquent in this manner. There are other constitutional questions. I don't want to dodge that question, Your Honor.
I don't want you to consume all your time on that, but I have been wondering. If they had been permitted to file this registration certificate with the Secretary of State, he could not have refused it, could he?
there's a dispute. Our opinion, which has never been written, I admit, our opinion is that he could. First of all, he has the duty to refer it to the franchise tax people for a determination of whether or not, in fact, this is a benevolent corporation within the meaning of the law of exemptions, or a charitable and
I suppose they offered to file as both. Could he have refused it?
Oh, he doesn't, in fact, accept the filing, and it is not accepted until the franchise tax people make a determination as to whether or not there are franchise taxes due. That's my understanding of the procedure.
Was there any basis for this action originally, except that they were delinquent in registration? The pleadings are not here, so that's the reason
For the action is that they were delinquent. The basis of the action is a long-term, extensive delinquency, which we think is in derogation of the rights of the people of Alabama not to have corporations come in, foreign corporations, and just ignore their statutes.
What do you say about their membership?
You mean, why is that relevant?
Yes, they're in a position that even though they can be forced to register, their membership is not required to be disclosed.
I disagree with that contention entirely. I don't believe a corporation has any right of privacy, and that any case of this court or has ever held any such thing. I can address myself to that. I think the recent cases, such as Watkins and Sweezy, are questions of assertions of individual rights. I see.
Well, before you sit down, you're doubtless familiar with the joint fascist cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
And therefore, you're doubtless familiar with the diversity of views expressed.
I am.
So that one cannot say that there was anything but a single judgment. But you will recall Mr. Justice Jackson's opinion, in which he sustained standing to sue on the part of the corporate entities, the non-individual bodies that were before us in that case, on the ground that if the individuals cannot assert their constitutional claim. Members, in other words, in an organization which is asked to make disclosures, and the individuals who are members can't themselves come in to protect what they claim to be a constitutional right without frustrating, without nullifying the very right which they claim by making a disclosure, that then the corporate body can assert those individual rights. In short, assume that individuals in Alabama, Tom, Dick, and Harry, with their appropriate surnames, can say, you can't ask us whether we belong to the NAACP. That's a territory that is protected. I'm making that assumption.
I understand.
Otherwise, there's no point. We can withhold. We don't have to tell Alabama or New York or anybody else what club we belong, provided it isn't there. Organizations. I'm putting that to one. That's our constitutional right. But if we have to go into court and say, here, what you're asking the organization to do makes inroads on my right, and by that very proceeding, you nullify your right, then the corporate body, having these undisclosable, its list of undisclosable membership, does have a standing to speak for the individual members.
My first answer, of course, is I don't agree with that portion of the opinion, but I'll also direct
my... It was an individual's opinion.
Individual opinion, that's what I mean. Mr.
Justice
Jackson.
He was quite candid in saying that he thought the corporation would not have standing to sue except in this strange situation where the individual right does come into action.
I would, if I may, address myself exactly to that question. First of all, Mr. Justice Jackson, preliminarily to making that statement, held that a corporation had no right of privacy, that, in fact, if all the order of the Attorney General in that case had done was hold the individual members up to contumely and unpopularity and all of the things which I might say are speculative in the instant case, pure speculation, that if that were all, he would say the corporation didn't have any standing. But that what had happened, and I want to remind you that it was entirely state action. Both the first and second pressures brought to bear were entirely state action. One was the ex parte action of the Attorney General in declaring the organization subversive, which I, insofar as there is a majority opinion, I would say was the basis of it. And then you get to the next step, which was by virtue of that order, here were a lot of innocent people who were going to lose jobs automatically. State and the jobs which they were going to lose automatically were government jobs, so that was obviously government action. Now, I perhaps haven't exactly answered the content. That is how I explain that decision.
But I suggest, and I suppose what is behind this claim of refusal to disclose the individuals who are members of the NACP in Alabama, I take it, I haven't read the pleading, but I take it the thought is, and the reason for this claim, why the individuals don't step forward, is because they are potentially in a damageable condition if they do make disclosure. That's why they withhold.
Damageable from whom is an important question. First of all, I would want to make a point which bears precisely on...
Damageable by the state.
Oh, the state isn't going to bring any pressure to bear on these individuals.
The pressure derives from the fact that the state compels disclosure if they may. Just as in the joint fascist case, if one of these organizations on the Attorney General's list had to make disclosure, it would affect people. Does it make any difference whether it's in private employment or public employment, so long as the governmental authority takes away something that it can't take away?
I don't believe that there's anything in the law that says that the mere fact that a person may become unpopular as a result of a disclosure gives him a constitutional right to secrecy.
That is an implication of my question. Is it inconceivable that an individual might bring a suit in Alabama and say, if I make a disclosure that I'm a member of the NACP, I lose my business? Is that an inconceivable hypothesis?
I have a hard time feeling that there'd be probably an embarrassing word, a justiciable issue there.
What, to lose business?
Unless he can get bring it against and allege extremely specific details in that. In other words, say that this person is, without justification, causing me to lose my business.
Well, this person being, the starting point is that the state of Alabama, or any other, the state of Massachusetts, doesn't make any difference, as far as I'm concerned, needless to say. The state is asking me to make a disclosure, which I'm entitled to withhold, and by making such disclosure, my business will be shut down. Government isn't shutting down the business, but it is taking action which results in the shutting down. And that's not justiciable?
Because the thing which may, and that's pure speculation, and the allegations in here are pure speculation.
They may not be able to make good on it. They may not be able to make good on it. But if you suppose that the joint fascist suit, that whole case turned on the fact that the Attorney General file what is practically a demurrer. Said, well, suppose everything you say is so. That's the only basis on which one has to meet these legal questions. Assume it's so that John Smith in Alabama, some town of Alabama, says, I received a request from the Attorney General to tell me whether I'm a member of the NACP, and I refuse to do so. And he says, well, that's required by some decree of a court. And if I make this disclosure, which I'm entitled to refuse to make, I will suffer in my business. Would that be demurrable?
I believe it would, and I'll explain why. I believe neither the Sweezy cases and the Watkins case, which seem to bear on this right to not to have to testify about associations, are answered on this basis. That in this case, we have relevancy to a judicial proceeding, and we submit an extremely valid judicial proceeding. And I might add, in this particular...
You mean mandamus?
No. To the central issue in the case of whether they're doing business in Alabama. and whether they should be ousted.
But suppose you win on that. Does that suppose you can oust them? In the meantime, suppose you're entitled to oust them. It doesn't follow from that individuals may have to make disclosures that they were members of the ousted corporation.
I agree.
If they can allege and subsequently prove that in fact the human inevitable consequence is material, monetary, mundane punishment in their property interest.
I don't think a person has such immunity from testifying in a case if he is properly subpoenaed.
Well, that goes to the merits of whether such an exaction can be made.
Oh, well, it does. And I fail to find any judicial authority for that particular.
What you're saying is that Alabama tomorrow can subpoena a lot of individuals in this litigation. Suppose this proceeds. Suppose you're allowed to proceed as the ouster proceeds. What you're saying is that as a matter of substantive constitutional law, if Alabama subpoenas Smith, Jones, Robinson, and asks him or her on the stand, are you now or were you a member of the NACP? They could not say, Your Honor, with every respect, I decline to answer because I'm protected by the Constitution. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
I think that we would have to show that our questions were relevant to the issues in the case.
I'm assuming they're relevant, yes.
I don't believe that he could. In fact, I deny that he could.
Very well.
I wish I could, but I'll not detain anyone further in this matter.
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Clerk, please. Mr. Justice Brennan and Mr. Justice Black expressed some interest in some of the pleadings which are not here. As you know, this was an ancillary proceeding, and this was the record which was certified and printed from the clerk of the Supreme Court of Alabama. Now, if the court desires, and with the court's permission, I would undertake to get the motions and all the other pleadings, if that is what is desired. With respect to the motion to stay and the first petition for writ of certiorari, the bill of complaint filed by the state, and our answer, if the court desires me to do that, I will certainly undertake to do that.
You have them here?
No, sir, we do not. They're in my office in New York, and I can have them printed if that's what the court wants me to do.
Well, I don't think necessarily to have them printed, but if you have a copy of them that can be delivered to our clerk, we do so. And if you have any additional documents that you'd like to have filed with the clerk, you may do so also, Mr. Reinhardt.
I think that the ultimate question, the preliminary question, rather, of jurisdiction, of course, will be decided by this court on a reading of the cases. But on the questions that were asked Mr. Reinhardt, I would like to direct the court's attention to page 15, an excerpt from Ex Parte Dickens, which we set out on page 15 of our petition for writ of certiorari, which I think shows without question that on certiorari, the court does go into the validity and the merits of the order, which is disobeyed.
We think he says it does go, Mr. Reinhardt very candidly admitted, that in fact the Supreme Court of Alabama goes ahead and talks about things which it says it needn't talk about. It does so merely makes a speech, as it were, because it restricts its decision to what it needs to restrict it to, namely, whether the jurisdiction is maintained on the face of the document.
Well,
in other words, if the state says, we go on this state ground, you've taken the wrong turning, you've followed the wrong procedure, but we're loose up here and we talk about things we needn't talk about, and so we make a speech.
I don't think, Mr. Frankfurt, that a reading of the cases which you will cite will sustain that position, except here, on certiorari, Supreme Court of Alabama talks about First Amendment freedoms, freedom from privilege of self-incrimination, and indicates, as this excerpt says, that they will go into the merits. And they don't, these opinions are not that we need go no further. These opinions are clearly on point. But as I say, I think the court will read the decisions and come to its own conclusions.
May I ask, Mr. Carter, are you suggesting that Dickens, Wheeler, Blakey, Boskowitz, Sellers, and Morris support your position?
Yes,
is that it?
Yes, sir.
And those are the ones you rely on particularly?
Those are the ones that we rely on.
What about Armstrong?
Well, the Armstrong, the reason I cited the Armstrong case was that merely to show that at times the Supreme Court of Alabama has treated these various papers filed as, even though they were called something else, has treated them as the proper paper. In other words, Armstrong could have come up on, should have come up, the Alabama said, on certiorari. It was a call, the petition for writ of mandamus, and the Supreme Court of Alabama said, we will treat it as a petition
for certiorari. Well, it said the affirmative, as I read it, were sufficient so that it might be considered as a petition for certiorari.
Because of the fact that in the Alabama pleadings, one asked on these pleadings for such other and further relief as the court may deem appropriate. On the basis of that, the Supreme Court of Alabama said that we will treat this as a petition for writ of certiorari, which, of course, is an entirely different question. And we merely raised this to show that the procedure is not as strict on this issue as the state attempts to maintain.
From what did you take your petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court?
We took our petition for writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court from the interlocutory or the restraining order from the first and second adjudications of contempt.
Of contempt?
Yes, sir.
Has the Supreme Court of Alabama, unless in this case, made a specific repudiation of what it said in Ex parte Dickens?
No, sir.
In that case, they had up the question of certiorari as a proper remedy for review contempt. The court said, we think that certiorari is a better remedy than mandamus, because the office of a mandamus is to require the lower court or judge to act and not to correct error or to reverse it. Or to reverse judicial action. Has that been referred to in later cases?
That has not been repudiated. That has been the law as we understood it until the decision in this case.
Was this case referred to in the decision of the Supreme Court?
Ex parte Dickens was referred to in the decision of the Supreme Court.
In this case?
In this case.
What was said about it?
I'll find it. No. Beginning on page 24, the last paragraph, the court says, of the record, I'm sorry,
of the record, yes, sir.
Where we've set out the court's opinion. The court says, on the petition for certiorari, the sole and only reviewable order or decree is that which adjudged the petitioner to be in contempt. Certiorari cannot be made a substitute for an appeal or other method of review. Certiorari lies to review an order or judgment of a contempt for the reason that there is no other method of review, citing ex parte Dickens.
They also referred to it. Did they distinguish it on the ground that one was civil and one criminal contempt?
As I understand it, the decision here, the distinction between civil and criminal contempt is not the reach of certiorari, but the question of what fine the court below may impose. In criminal contempt under Alabama law, the court is limited by statute to the amount of fine. If an individual, they can incarcerate an individual or order him incarcerated for 5 days, and the fine is $50. On civil contempt, the court's power is unlimited to the kind of punishment it may impose. And this was the distinction which the court makes with respect to this case. As we read the decision, an ex parte Dickens is referred to throughout the opinion. The court was really misquoting and misciting its own decisions, because ex parte Dickens specifically says that certiorari used to be limited by jurisdiction, or the questions of jurisdiction, but that now it could reach the question of the merits. I just see my time is up, but I just wanted...
You may have 5 minutes to which to summarize your argument, Mr.
Well, our position here and our contentions are that this is not appropriately a proceeding to require us out to register. I think that's clear from what was said today, and it's clear from the papers and what has happened in this case. If the Alabama wanted the corporation to register, we offered to register, and we would have done so. Now, so this is really not what this case is all about. We think that Alabama, because of the ideas which we espouse, that Alabama has sought to use the far failure to register, which they knew for a long number of years, and which has been very obvious in Alabama for many years, our failure to register as a device to suppress the organization and to oust us from the state.
Take your time, but I don't understand why you argue this, because unless I completely misunderstood Mr. Reinhardt, the state isn't arguing here that we have to pass on Alabama's right of ouster. That isn't an issue at all.
Well, I understand the...
The issue here is the validity of the contempt order as against certain constitutional claims.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes, sir. But our position is, if the court please, that at the very outset, the Alabama courts, the court in this instance, took illegal action because the only action that we are aware of that Alabama could exert against the corporation for failure to register was the action which is the statutory penalties which are set out in our brief at page 35. So that we are faced at the very outset with being put out of business without a hearing, and then being ordered as a condition of having a hearing on the merits of that claim, we are then required to either submit to what we consider unconstitutional conditions or, in effect, stay ousted and have a final judgment entered against us in effect, because we cannot prosecute this claim until the contempt proceedings have been finally adjudicated. As I indicated yesterday, our view is that the order requiring our members to requiring the production of the names of our members has no relevance to the question as to whether or not we are doing business in the state. And particularly, we believe this is so, since we have taken that issue out of the case by ourselves indicating to the state that we are willing to comply with the law insofar as registration is concerned.
By some procedure which Alabama affords.
Yes, sir.
Or whether until it's at least raised in some way, which the Alabama law specifies.
Are you're talking of the temporary restraining
yes.
law?
Yes. Now I'm talking about the order to produce.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I agree.
And is the same thing true on the temporary restraining order? There. It was the court had jurisdiction and power to handle it. Didn't it? Yes. Whether it's right or wrong. Now then, until a motion to dissolve it has been denied, you're not out of that court. No way to go anyplace else. And isn't that right? And therefore, you can't have a review of that temporary injunction until. You have had an order of ruling the motion to dissolve.
Well, we think that order was put in issue, necessarily put in issue, by the opinion of the Supreme Court of Alabama, which indicated that the court below had jurisdiction. that when it went to the question, we contend that it had no jurisdiction to oust us from the state on the basis of this plea. And that therefore, the temporary restraining order is at issue because we raised it in the Supreme Court of Alabama. In other words, we think that not only is the Alabama wrong in ordering us to produce the names of our members, but we think that at the outset, the state court was wrong in dissolving, in fact, barring us from the state without a hearing, because our contention is that there's no authority under Alabama law and on the basis of this record for this to be done.
Well, the thing that you say barred you from Alabama was the temporary injunction.
Yes, sir.
Is that before us? Can there be a review of it at the point now until a motion to dissolve it has been presented and denied?
Well, our theory, if the court please, our theory is that it is properly before the court because Alabama acted arbitrarily in the first instance. In issuing the temporary restraining order on the basis of this record that there was no jurisdiction.
No jurisdiction in the court at all?
Well, our contention is that there is no jurisdiction in Alabama court to do what to restrain us on the basis of this record as a foreign corporation for our failure to register. This is our contention. And that when the court, the Supreme Court of Alabama, sustained jurisdiction, that it necessarily approved the jurisdiction of the court in this respect, and that is before the court here.
Well, I think it would naturally follow. If the court had no jurisdiction of the cause, then everything it did was a nullity.
Right. Our view is, of course. Our view is that they have no right.
Jurisdiction.
No jurisdiction. That the only power that the Alabama has, but on the basis of our failure to register, was to, one, require us to register or issue the statutory penalty set out in page 35 of our brief.